And just to follow up what Stephanie was saying before, Stephanie Wells, who is the executive director of Pacifica, just wanted to follow up by saying, yes, if you want to support this radio station, please consider becoming a financial supporter by calling this number, 833-922-4692. That's 833-922-4692 or 833-WBAINYC. 833-WBAINYC. Now, stay tuned for the next program, which happens to be Labor and Healthcare Confidential with Marianne Pensatola, and it's 5 p.m. Stay tuned.
Sunday passing by, I'll be working here forever, at least until I die. Damn if you do, damn if you don't. I'm supposed to get a raise next week, you know that when I won't. Working for a living, whack. Working for a living, whack. Working for a living, living and a working. I'm taking what they're giving, cause I'm working for a living.
Good afternoon, WBAI listeners. This is Marianne Pizzatola. I am the president of the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees, the largest retiree organization of 250,000 municipal retirees in the city of New York who have been fighting to protect our earned Medicare benefits from being rolled back in retirement by the city of New York. I welcome you to this episode of the Labor and Healthcare Confidential, discussing topics on healthcare and labor, both locally and nationwide. I'm coming to you via WBAI 99.5 FM, a listener-sponsored non-commercial radio here in New York City. This is a Pacifica radio station, and we can be live streamed on WBAI.org. Today is Monday, August 25th, 2025, and Reggie is our audio engineer. On the Labor and Healthcare Confidential, we focus on labor workforce issues and their accomplishments in healthcare and New York City nationwide. If you would like to download an episode of this podcast after the show, you can find us on WBAI.org's archive page. In today's healthcare news, two Queens residents tested positive for West Nile virus, with one hospitalized for neuroinvasive disease and the other briefly hospitalized for West Nile fever, but was released. Two possible cases in Brooklyn are under investigation, and the virus was detected in blood donations in both Brooklyn and Staten Island. A Yonkers man was diagnosed with no further details provided. Most infected individuals are asymptomatic, but some may experience fever, headache, muscle aches, rash, and fatigue. Those over 55 or immunocompromised are at higher risk for severe illness. An average of 31 New Yorkers are diagnosed with neuroinvasive disease annually. Preventative measures including using EPA-registered repellent, wearing long sleeves, eliminating standing water, and ensuring intact window screens. Mosquitoes carrying the virus are most active in NYC from August to October. Virus activity can be tracked on the city's healthcare website. A sixth death has been reported in the Legionnaires' disease outbreak in Harlem, first identified in July 25th of 2025. And as of August 22nd, 111 confirmed cases have been recorded, with seven people currently hospitalized. The outbreak was linked to 12 cooling towers in 10 buildings in central Harlem, including Harlem Hospital and a CUNY building, of which all have been drained and disinfected. Cases are concentrated in five zip codes, with the last new case reported on August 13th. Two lawsuits have been filed against construction companies for unsafe conditions, and a third lawsuit is planned against New York City's health and hospitals, seeking at least $1 million in damages. The hospital claims its cooling tower safety program exceeds safety requirements. And in the national news, a story that can affect your medication. President Trump's threats to impose tariffs on imported medicines have highlighted the complex global supply chain for pharmaceuticals, where drugs are rarely produced in a single country. Raw materials are often imported to create active pharmaceutical ingredients, also called APIs, which are then shipped to another country for final formulation into tablets or liquids. Data from the U.S. Pharmacopeia, USP, shared with the New York Times shows that newer patent-protected drugs like those for cancer or obesity are primarily being made in Europe and the United States, while India and China dominate production of lower-cost generics like statins and antibiotics. And that's really important to follow because most of us who are in union drug plans, we are generic-based drug plans, and knowing that this could become a problem could potentially force us to use the name brand products that would come with a higher cost. Some of those drugs include amoxicillin, which is a generic antibiotic with ingredients produced in four different countries and formulated into finished drugs in four countries, with Jordan supplying 46% of the U.S. market. It's a thin profit margin that makes it vulnerable to tariffs and shortages. The also popular weight medications, Ozempic and Wegovy, Novo Nordisk produces all those ingredients in Denmark, with final formulation split between Denmark and the United States. These expensive injectables face a potential 15% tariff under the US-EU trade deal. Viagra, originally made in Ireland by Pfizer, became a generic in 2017, with India now dominating both API and final formulation, fueling affordable online sales through telemedicine. Losartan, a generic blood pressure medication with most of its ingredients made in China, raising national security concerns and final tablets formulated in India, which could be impacted by tariffs. And then lidocaine, a generic injectable with ingredients and final vials produced in multiple countries, prone to shortages due to complex production and a low profit margin, which tariffs could worsen. The global production pattern for U.S. drugs mirrors other regions, although some, like Latin America, rely on local manufacturing. Tariffs could disrupt supply chains, particularly for generics with tight margins and existing shortage risks. That's our healthcare news for this week. And after this brief short break, we will be speaking with today's guests, Jen Coffey.
I was told I'd have it made at 65. Uncle Sam would help me keep myself alive. For just a small copay, my pains would go away, and my savings wouldn't have to take a dive. So I went right to my doctor on that day. He said he could fix my problems right away. He listened to my chest, sent me for some tests, and my Medicare account was on its way. Medicare, 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 Medicare. I was told to sign right up and get my share. There was nothing wrong with me, not as far as I could see, but I qualified to get on Medicare.
Isn't that a cute song, Jen? My guest today is Jen Coffey. She's from Manchester, New Hampshire, and at one time she was an EMT just like me, held down multiple jobs simultaneously, one of which was a state representative from New Hampshire. She was a Republican and the vice chair of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, and for 20 years she served as a medical tech in the hospital and an EMT in the street. All of that changed when she was diagnosed with breast cancer at the young age of 42, and in 1 year had three surgeries and lost everything, her career, her home, and everything. She was bedbound for over 2 years. She developed small fiber neuropathy and CRPS, known as complex regional pain syndrome, another thing that she and I both had in common. The most painful disease known to modern medicine is also known as the suicide disease. Living on a disability, she was unable to afford treatments, and then the denials from Medicare Advantage came. She was forced to sell all of her possessions to try to receive care that she was forced to ration. She had to take her struggles public in order to access care, and it wasn't an easy choice for her to put her life out there for all of the world to see, but her last hope was that continuing her treatments on a desperate act was to live. Welcome to our show, Jen, and know that I am in this fight with you, and you and I both know this fight very well.
I wish we didn't have that in common, you know?
I know.
I wish we met in a truck.
We would have been great partners in the streets together.
Oh my God, that would have been so crazy to have you for a partner. I would have loved it. I would have have loved that. I miss it all the time. Every time I see somebody in uniform, you know, it's like,
I had one of my favorite partners was Donna. Donna was a partner of mine in Queens and the Bronx, and we were known as the Bodacious Buff Babes.
That's awesome. I love that.
It was. We started working in Brooklyn together. So
now
tell
here
us
we
a little
are,
bit
both
about
of us.
Your yeah. So tell us a little bit about your fight. Tell us what's been going on. And you're a healthcare advocate, and you're a pretty strong one at that.
It's more of a battle these days, I think, than it was before. For me personally, it's basically become a brick wall at this point. In the past, I've had help from my senator and from the Senator of Medicare Services, who oversees all Medicare products. So, of course, that includes Medicare Advantage products. And United Healthcare just loves to deny and delay care, as many of us unfortunately know from personal experience. And as you said, yeah, I was bedbound for over 2 years, but what got me out of that bed was ketamine infusions. And that's also what stopped me having to take Oxy and Valium and be on a fentanyl patch. And I basically laid in a bed for over 2 years wanting to die because I had no life and I was in agony. The pain meds just snow your head. They don't actually make it stop.
Right.
Unlike the infusions, which rework on the receptors in the body that shut them down. So it actually, think of it like a fire, right? Put the water on the fire, it sizzles it down. Well, one of the common symptoms with CRPS and something that I experience is a burning sensation that's literally like being on fire. I mean, at its worst, it's like being on fire while you're walking around with barbed wire around you through a briar patch on broken glass barefooted. And you're gonna come close to understanding what it is that I feel. It was landing me in the hospital all the time. I had no life. The infusions gave me that back, took those meds away. But the infusions are expensive and hundreds and hundreds of dollars for every infusion. And I was paying for it out of pocket because of course insurance wouldn't cover it. And I was doing all right until my rent went up $400 and the money had to come from somewhere. So I started rationing the infusions and that was getting really hard. I was not doing well and I was getting to a point where I was housebound again and couldn't like go out. So I heard about the Care of a Cost campaign that People's Action does through Rights and Democracy New Hampshire, my local org. And they were looking for people who were willing to go public to fight for, to show the world, to show the nation, to show the leadership what's happening to people on the ground when they need the care, when the care provider becomes the patient. And they took my story and we did videos, we did a petition, we wrote a letter to then CEO Andrew Witte, who made $25 million in 1 year. 1 year. Every year that man made over $20 million. For a very long time. And that's really disheartening when you think about hundreds of dollars for my infusion and they're saying no. They were happier with me on cheap drugs that kept me drugged up and laying in a bed and not costing them money. Now I want treatment. I want to actually get out of bed and have a life. So we had to fight them. We had to embarrass them to get them to finally agree. And I had to talk to the senators and CMS fought for me. And they finally issued a letter saying that, yes, they are. It is, in fact, medically necessary for you to have these infusions to treat complex regional pain syndrome and small fiber neuropathy. And for just about 2 years, they did cover. But I had to fight for every prior authorization, for every freak. It was always an argument. And then sometimes I get the prior authorization, right? But then they won't pay the bill. There was one infusion. They paid $1.22. So of course I appealed that because I'm on the hook for anything under the $600 that I have to pay out of pocket. And I'm lucky. I'm grandfathered into my clinic. It currently costs $950 per infusion. And that's not unreasonable when you consider You're being infused for 4 hours. You're under sedation. You have heart monitors, oxygen monitors, the staff to do all of that. It's not necessarily cheap to keep those lights on.
Right.
So it's not an unreasonable cost, right? But UnitedHealthcare is like, $1.10. That's all you're worth. So of course I had to appeal it, and I appealed it, and then they decided that on appeal, it was $1.22 they paid. On appeal, they decided to drop it to $1.10. They decided
right.
they paid 11 cents too much. So I had to go back to my senator, back to CMS, and make another public spectacle and argue with them in order to get them to actually pay the frickin' bill. And it was then that they paid $833, which is a very reasonable amount of money to pay my doctor. Still less than what other people pay, but reasonable. And they've never paid that again. It's been an argument to get to they nickel and dime on everything. They constantly say that there's no reason to cover cardiac monitoring, though I am under sedation. Not understanding how that's logical.
Yeah.
Right? Right? No monitor. You don't need to be monitored. We're just going to put you
on. When you said before that you thought that they wanted you dead, I think after hearing you say that, I think you're right. Right.
Well, now what they're doing to me now is they've now decided that though my diseases are not cured and they actually have gotten worse, not better, I am no longer covered. They've told me that they called me and told me, they didn't put it in writing, they called and told me, and they've refused to give me a prior authorization. So I have no approved infusions. They will not cover it. They say it's no longer medically necessary. Filed. And then they also tell me that I need to go to a different provider because my provider is out of network with them. I went to my senator, filed another complaint with CMS, and they said, why don't you try another insurance? I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, that's even an option right now, right? And then
Medicare
they're like,
told you to find another insurance plan?
Yes. The Center for Medicare Services that's supposed to enforce the laws said, why don't you try some other insurance? And they also told me that this was my fault because I am making a preference to see a doctor who's out of network. Even though I have told them in so many different ways, including the last thing I sent to them was a giant sentence in almost all caps. This is not a preference. You are asking me to give up care because not one of those doctors that you're offering me offers infusions. Not one. None of them do it. Not a one. So
now,
I have to give up care.
We had a retiree that was a 9/11 responder who, I may get some of the details wrong, but the fact is generally the same. He said to me that he needed a specific doctor. It was like, I'll just say like a mental health doctor, for example. And then they gave him a list of doctors who he could see in the network. And one was a podiatrist. Like the doctor didn't even have the specialty and training
right.
to provide the care
right.
that this person saw. So you're telling me that they were trying to tell you to change doctors and there were no doctors that did this specific
correct.
Treatment.
And then they're blaming me for my choice and telling me it's my choice to go to an out-of-network provider. No, it's my choice to not give up access to care. I pay out of it cash for it. If I need an infusion, I pay cash. I have three medications I pay cash for because they won't pay for it because they say they're not medically necessary. Or one that they'll say, oh, sure, we'll pay for it, but your copay is over $80. So I got a cost plus, Mark Cuban's thing, and
right.
I get it for $30 with shipping. Because
oh
my insurance company at UnitedHealthcare chastised me. They were like, you know, when you buy from other places or use GoodRx, you want me to pay over $80 a month for this prescription. I'm doing a mail away to get 30 with somebody else. I have so many pharmacies, it's not okay. No one pharmacist has my chart. Nobody knows me completely anymore because that's what it requires in order to get the price as low as I possibly can. Because I mean, I am no stranger to spending hundreds, thousands of dollars to stay alive at this point. When I first started, it killed me. How can I spend this much money on a med? How can I? But what's the choice? Die? They'd rather I die. UnitedHealthcare would rather I die because then I will cost them less money, right? Then they're not paying for as many doctor's visits. They're not paying for other medications because they do have to pay for those things. They don't get out of everything. But as far as the doctor thing's going and what happened to the person in New York City, the law says that the company is required to have an adequate network, not one provider, an adequate network. So when they don't even have a single solitary provider to offer you, you would think that the Senator for Medicare Services would look at them and go, hey, the law says, and we're going to enforce the law says you have to have it. And if you don't, you have to cover at the in-network rate. That's what the law says. And that law person told me to try another insurance or to go to a doctor who doesn't do my treatment. Maybe it's better for them if I go back on Oxy and Valium and fentanyl patches and I have no life and I lay in a bed and I have to wear the Delta pens because I can't even hold my own bladder anymore. I want to have a life worth living. Is that so sad to ask for? I thought I did everything right in my life. I volunteered. I did so much work under volunteering. I can't even tell you. I did everything that I thought the right way. Bought a house, saved money. And in the end, I've lost it all. And now I'm fighting just to stay alive every freaking day, just to stay alive.
Let me ask you a question. You said that you had taken this fight publicly as an, I guess, like a way to shame UnitedHealthcare into providing you or approving you the treatment that your doctor wanted you to have, that even Medicare affirmed that was medically necessary for what you were being treated for. And yet you had to make this fight very public. Yeah. Tell me about that move. Because that had to be very difficult to share something so private.
It really was more difficult than I think most people understand. And I don't even know if I've said this publicly before, but I was in a really not so great place. And my life, when the cancer happened, was horrible. I was married to a man who had climbed into a bottle and forgot he had a family. And he was horrible. And almost every single night, he would tell me to hurry up and die. And it was really hard to take my...
I'm so sorry.
I spent so much time. I spent years and I destroyed a lot of relationships because I tried to hide from everything. I had had a public life. I did my volunteering. I just wanted to live out the rest of my days, however they may be, in peace. And I really had to make a decision on whether I really wanted to die or not, right? Because if I really didn't want to die, I was going to have to fight for this because the money was just not there. I mean, $400 was so much money to come up with all at once. I didn't know what else to do. And I was having infusions every 4 to 6 weeks at that time. So I just stopped.
And the pain, the tremendous pains. Mm-hmm.
I can't even explain to you how torturous it is and how much your brain doesn't function correctly when you are so locked in pain that you, like, and it doesn't go away. Think about this, all right? When people get tortured, the person doing the torture is going to stop. They're going to sleep. They're going to go to the bathroom. They're going to eat. They're going to stop hurting you at some point to take a break for themselves. CRPS never does that. It doesn't matter. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the middle of the night, in your sleep, you will feel it. I do not get sleep like other people do, despite the medications they give me to sleep, because my body feels it, despite whether or not I am alert to it or not. And the disease does more than just cause pain. And pain is just seems like such a small world to use for something that literally feels all-consuming, that literally disrupts every aspect of your being. It's impossible to think a straight thought when you're in absolute agony rolling around in a bed and nothing works. I mean, they've given me some heavy duty drugs to the point where they almost killed me once. All of a sudden, my heart rate dumped and the last thing I heard was my son screaming for help. That was the last thing I heard. And I woke up being hypoxic and fighting with them trying to keep oxygen on me. Cause they had over-medicated me and dumped it and I still felt the pain. They threatened me with putting me in a nursing home if I wouldn't accept being on opioids, narcotics, and fentanyl. And that was the alternative. And I will never let anybody put me there again, not UnitedHealth, not anybody else. I will never go back on those drugs, ever. I will fight to my very last breath, and I will pay every dime that I can to keep my health to a point where I can have a life worth living. And when the day comes that I can't do that anymore, then we will have a different discussion.
You've been through a lot. And And I feel some of your pain as I've been down some of those roads with you, especially dealing with CRPS, with breast cancer. It's the things that you've had in your life are tremendous. You, like me, are a person that takes care of other people, and we struggle sometimes to take care of our own selves. I'm very glad that you are here with us today and that you chose to fight this, not only for yourself, but for publicly, because you've become a warrior on this scene and in advocating for healthcare, not just for your own self, but for other people that are being denied healthcare access and treatments, not just from United Healthcare, but from all vendors in the country. And that is, I give that tribute to you because you've been wonderful in working besides in this fight. You and I met back in 23 when we were down in DC with Be a Hero, national organization, Audie Barkin's Be a Hero, and Social Security Works with Alex Lawson. And we traveled the halls of Congress together. And I was so very grateful to meet you that day. And I'm glad that you are doing better and that you're here and you've taken this fight nationally. You even did a rally in the city where you were you dressed up like the CEO. We have a few minutes left, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, we went to New York. We went to the New York Stock Exchange because United Healthcare was releasing their record profits yet again, which average around $8 billion every 3 months. And we wanted to make sure that the public knew what they spend that on, you know, because they have two Gulfstream jets, for example, because they're not going to fly in a plane with us, the peasants. They can only fly privately. You know, these people are raising our premiums. They've taken away dental care. Like, they used to cover fillings now. Now they don't cover fillings anymore. Now you can only have x-rays and a cleaning, and that's all it covers, and only up to $750, and only for those things. And yet they raise the premiums again, and they're going to raise the premiums again next year. This is the worst fleecing of Americans that have ever happened. And it's the greatest racket in the country because they're making hand over fist money on the backs of the dead, the dying, and those that are being denied health care. So, yeah, like you, I guess, unselfishly, a part of me gets a little bit to still be an EMT as long as I'm in this fight. And I'm going to keep going back and forth to D.C. and rattling the halls of the legislature and trying to fight for health care for everybody. We all deserve it. We're all human beings. But if you want to know what I do more, visit me at jenncoffey.com, JenCoffey.com. My email's there. Go to the contact page. You can email me directly. I got a basic Gmail account, JenCoffey16@gmail.com. I want to hear from you. I want to hear your stories. I want to help you fight for the care that you and your loved ones need. Nobody deserves to be denied the care that you and I help pay for, by the way. Our tax dollars have developed many of these medications and treatments. They fund your local hospitals. You have a right to all of that. These are not give outs. These are not handouts. These are the insurance policies that you and I paid into our entire working life. And we are deserved of those things. These are benefits we paid into, not handouts. So anybody that tries to feed you that line of malarkey, shut them right down. It's one of my biggest
pet peeves. You get angry, your accent comes out more, Jen.
I get, you know, that's one of my biggest pet peeves is when they try and say Social Security disability insurance is a handout. It's insurance, it's a handout. Social Security itself is a handout, or Medicare. None of these things are handouts. They are all things that you and I have paid for since the day we got our first paycheck. The first paycheck I ever got, the taxes came out of, I was 15. Not that I didn't work before then, but my whole life I paid into that. I have a right to that money. I have a right to the insurance I paid into, and every single one of us do. And by the way, that's how insurance works. So if anybody tells you, I don't want to pay for anybody else's care, that's another line of malarkey, because you are if you pay for insurance. That's how insurance works. It's a pool. Everybody pays into the pool, and the pool is supposed to pay the bills. But what they do is divert that pool, including our Medicare trust fund dollars, into their own grubby pockets. Because, you know, making $1 million, $2 million, $20 million, that's not enough money for them in profit. These people make United Healthcare alone, fourth largest company in the United States, most of the most profitable nationwide, not just healthcare. $8 billion every 3 months they make in profit, and they still cry poor mouth, and they still demand more of your tax dollars. And it's not going to stop unless you stand up with me and with you, Marianne, because that's the only thing that we can do to fight back. Because let me tell you, they got $1 million lobbyists up on the hill, so you've got to send us up there to fight back.
And yet still, while they're making those record billion-dollar profits, they're still denying your care and denying your prior authorization, and they're cutting back, like you talked about, those extra perk plans that they advertise in the Medicare Advantage plans, restricting your dental care and vision care, and I don't know, probably reducing your debit cards.
Oh,
It's ridiculous.
what debit card? There's no debit card. Not here.
I'm gonna
Not
retire in
here. There's
Florida and
no
get to
debit card here.
yeah.
Not in this state. Not New Hampshire. We
Yeah,
barely get
Florida.
coverage. We barely have coverage. The
She
copays are
gets.
insane. It's $75 copay to see a specialist out of network.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that's what I'm fighting against every time I try and see my doctor or have a treatment. Copay, co-insurances, 50%. It's insane.
On your Medicare Advantage plan?
That's what I'm fighting with because they refuse to cover them in network. Because I should go see one of their people and give up treatment and just go back on the drugs, man. You were cheaper then. I swear. UnitedHealthcare keeps trying to kill me off and they're not going to succeed because I'll be damned to let them win.
You keep fighting, Jen.
You too. Keep doing this. I'm so proud of you and I'm so thankful for you doing this because we need it. We all need it. Thank you for all you do.
Amen, sister. And if anyone who wants to get in touch with Jen, remember it's jencoffey.com, JenCoffey.com. You can read about her story there and contact her. And if you're having trouble securing your health care or being needing some help fighting your denials, reach out to her for some guidance and advice. She's a true warrior. Thank you, Jen. It was great talking to you today. I look forward to talking to you again. And I agree, I will be coming to DC the next time you go. If I can, I'll bring my retirees with you. So you have a great day. Thank you for joining us and sharing us a very personal story with our listeners. And we will be right back after this brief break with Joe Maniscalco. Thank you.
I was told I'd have it made at 65. Uncle Sam would help me keep myself alive. For just a small copay, my pains would go away, and my savings wouldn't have to take a dive. So I went right to my doctor on that day. He said he could fix my problems right away. He listened to my chest, sent me for some tests, and my Medicare account was on its way. Medicare, Medicare,
Medicare.
I was told to sign right up and get my share. There was nothing wrong with me, not as far as I could see, but I qualified to get on Medicare.
You are listening to the Labor and Healthcare Confidential on WBAI. I am Maryam Pizzatola, and thank you for the sustaining sponsorships from both national labor unions and some local unions. WBAI and the Pacifica radio station are able to bring you live daily programming. Become a part of the WBAI family and be a sustaining member. Make your monthly donation starting today. If you're enjoying what you've been listening to, you can become a buddy or make a one-time donation. We need you to show your support. You can call 1-833-WBAI-NYC. That's 1-833-922-4692. And if no one answers, just leave a voicemail message with your name and number and someone will call you back. You can also just simply send a check or money order to WBAI Pacifica, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Think about becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month, and mention this show, the Labor and Healthcare Confidential, or just go to the WBAI.org website or call our number, 1-833-WBAI-NYC. Now, moving into our next segment, Joe Maniscalco is a journalist and freelance writer based here in New York City, a Work Bites journalist. He's a nonprofit team of dedicated labor writers with decades of combined street cred covering every facet of American labor movement and workplace justice. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks. And now I feel silly having to follow Jen.
She made me tear.
I mean, that's got to go in a vault. That testimony should be blasted out nationwide. I mean, she so casually laid out this incredibly profound situation that people are in. I mean, that's a call for action right there.
Absolutely.
You can't go on and continue your day after hearing that.
No, you can't. And knowing that from the moment she was diagnosed with breast cancer, in trying to stay afloat, having a husband who became an alcoholic and trying to sustain her family, trying to save her own life, then developing this complication of complex regional pain syndrome where your nerves literally short circuit and it creates a situation. The easiest way I can explain this to people, because I've lived through this after 9/11, I had multiple surgeries on my right leg, and literally your nerves forget what a sensation feels like. So if you were to take a cotton ball and rub that on your arm, it would feel soft and fuzzy. That's the normal sensation. But for people who have CRPS, that cotton ball doesn't feel like a cotton ball. It feels like a chunk of hot coal with glass shards sticking out of it, in a fire. And you cannot stop this burning, painful sensation. And it doesn't end. And for me, it was in my right leg. And then it went to my left leg, and then in my le right leg, left leg, and right arm. So it became extremely painful to sleep. Like even just a sheet or your clothing or your shoe would cause that reaction. Still today, I get that reaction with cold, air conditioning, or weather. And that pain doesn't stop until the nerve decides it wants to stop it. And that first modality of treatment, like she explained, was to put you on meds, opioids, fentanyl, Percocet, then Neurontin. And before you know it, the pain's just kind of dulled. It didn't go away, but now it's messing with your brain and other parts of your body. I mean, she's really gone through so much to get to this point. And that's why they literally call it the suicide disease, because it's a never-ending pain that your brain goes to a point where you think the only way out of this is to not be here. So to go
And
through all of
so many
that.
things that Jen talked about, so many, I just took down, some notes, just quotes. They would rather I die, she said.
Yes.
They chastised me.
Yes.
Met a person going to an insurance company that is supposed to cover them, asking for help, gets chastised.
They did. And she had to keep going to her senators to try to get every month she had to fight for her treatment. And she would go to a senator to help her. And then now she told me before they have no weight anymore. Like they, no matter what they do, they can't help her get her treatment approved.
No, she'd be better off, going to a closet and talking to a bunch of empty suits, because
Right.
that's all they are. I mean, it's all an illusion that they're there to re represent Jen and the rest of us. They're not. They get in that position because they represent power and money and insurance companies.
Right. And she couldn't afford a traditional Medicare, so she went into Medicare Advantage, and now she's stuck there. She has all these pre-existing conditions. The state that she lives in is New Hampshire, which she'd be subject to underwriting. It would cause a problem for her to get health. And that's if she could afford it. This is what concerns us when we hear other states, other retirees, like retirees from Cortland County, New York, calling us to say they're trying to push us into Medicare Advantage again, and by UnitedHealthcare. And the main hospital in Cortland County is Cayuga Medical, does not accept UnitedHealthcare Medicare Advantage. That's the main facility in this tiny little upstate New York county. So when I hear stories like Jen, it touches me. I met her, like we said, in DC, and we've both been kind of fighting this parallel fight.
It's amazing. You notice how you can never vote for somebody like Jen. Somebody like Jen is never on the ballot. The closest she'll get is somebody pretending, trying to create this narrative that they're like Jen, but of course they're not. And
Yeah.
that should tell everybody what they're up against, knowing that, we can't have people like that. And that's who you want, to be in a position of leadership.
And she
Somebody.
was. If you listen to the beginning of our interview, she was a New Hampshire state elected official. And she had to stop when she got her diagnosis. And she was like me, an EMT in the street, and she worked in a hospital. So she took care of people. She was one of those people, but now, even as a former elected, has no ability to fight this other than publicly.
Yeah, I mean, the system will let a couple people filter in now and then to keep up the illusion. But by and large, yeah. If you know, working people, if they don't take action themselves, like Jen is doing now, like you are doing, Marianne, with the retirees, it's not going to get done.
I know, it's crazy. So you have a couple of articles. You were quite busy this week.
Yeah, I mean, the news never stops, and we're doing the best we can to give people just a collective, like a collage of the workspace, you know, because a lot of these things that I cover, you know, there's different sectors, different kinds of people, different kind of jobs, but it always comes down to, you know, this system that is subjecting working people to the things that they're subjected to.
And that power of collective action where people are still fighting, and we really need a 2-hour show, I think, every week to talk about all the things coming out of Washington that's a threat to unionism and a threat to collective bargaining, a threat to collective action, and the destruction of the federal unions, which is even more destructive than what's happening here in New York. But you are also reporting on some farm workers trying to organize in the face of chilling ice raids. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, so farm workers, you know, traditionally have always been left out of the conversation on worker rights. You know, whenever there's a gain made, you know, you'll notice, you know, just going back decades, oh, there's a carve out where whatever wins that working people have achieved, oh, there's a carve out accepting, you know, farm workers and other workers sometimes too. But, you know, 5 years ago, right? Finally, because of the pandemic, people were starting to realize, oh, wow, these people who are invisible, who I overlook, they're actually responsible for putting food on our table. But now, fast forward to today, and you know, it's not that long, and these people being hunted down by, you know, what I call modern slave catchers. And so now they've started organizing amongst themselves, despite all the pressures. They're organizing and coordinating these ice watches, you know, in the workplace to prepare themselves, you know, from when ice does come, and try to take people who, you know, they're snatching people on their way to work.
Well, and what I thought was interesting too is that in the article, it mentions that the union members are trying to position themselves, that might have been the other article, in between ICE and the worker.
Yeah, that's one of the official spokesperson I talked to from United Food Chain Workers. That's a coalition of like 33 different groups representing like 375,000 farm workers in United States and Canada. And she was saying, you know, this is what it's come to. You know, if you support us, and you know, if you believe in us, you know, and you have that mindset from 5 years ago, is like, oh yeah, these workers really are essential. You need to stand up. You know, if you can do it, you need to stand up and get in between, you know, somebody getting taken away, kidnapped off the streets. You know, it's gotten to that point.
That was the other article, yes. Amigas en la Lucha panel highlights challenges for labor organizers. So in this article, what made me start thinking about these two articles that you wrote, there's a large group of women that purchase cosmetics, for example, that want to make sure that their cosmetics are humanely used or tested on humanely on animals. So we're more interested in that humanity to animals, but here are people who are literally picking your fruits and vegetables and preparing, getting your meals for your family, and we're not worried about about their safety, even about heat. So in EMS, we had to train, it's called an EVOC class, an emergency vehicle operating course, where we had to train literally on the fields of blacktop at a what is the in Brooklyn, there's the military base, I think that was like decommissioned, Floyd Bennett Field. We used to train in Floyd Bennett Field in the empty parking lot with a crash course. Like they would, you had to take your vehicle and go through a series of cones and drive the vehicle forward back. But anyway, it was on blacktop. And in the middle of the summer, the heat radiating off blacktop could be well over 100 degrees. The union had a rule that if the heat was over X amount of degrees, and I don't remember because it was like 30 something years ago, but they would make us stop the training and put us in an air-conditioned bus to cool us down and then take a break and then go back outside. This is one of those things that they're blocking with these farm workers working in the heat in very high temperatures and literally either getting disabled or injured or dying from these heat illnesses.
Yeah, I think the figure is farm workers are 35 times more likely to die from heat-related stress than other dangerous occupations. And that was really the point of that article, that people are organizing in the face of all of these ICE raids, but that it is having a chilling effect for people who need to speak out about dangerous workplace conditions. You know, if
Right.
you're afraid that you're going to get snatched and deported, you're going to keep your, you're more likely you're going to keep your head down, and you're not going to challenge, oh, I didn't get, I've been out here working under the hot sun, I didn't even get a friggin' water break. So,
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. It's not humanity. It's not humane. It's not humanity. It's not labor. It's this anti-labor.
but that is actually what these businesses are arguing. They're saying to extend this basic humanity to workers is onerous and would disrupt the workflow. So like in June, they started holding hearings on these new OSHA heat regulations that were pending. Like one of the first thing that Trump did when he came into office, one of the first things he did on January 20 was cancel all of these pending regulations. And one of them was a heat standard, saying a nationwide heat standard. You work outside, you need to get a 15-minute break every 2 hours if the heat index exceeds 90 degrees. So you had the Chamber of Commerce, other business groups screaming, "Holy hell! Oh no, we can't do that. We can't allow that. That'd be too onerous on businesses." That would disrupt the workflow. With a straight face, people are arguing this.
I was just talking to my attorney today, and I said to him about we were talking about work inconveniences, because I wanted to talk about, which we'll need to talk about eventually, that case coming out of Alabama with the National Labor Relations Board, which is another very huge story to discuss, about how the decisions from the Trump administration is literally hobbling or making it unable the NLRB to resolve labor cases, unfair labor practices. So I literally said to him today, this, do you remember a couple of months ago, Hofstra University was preparing for they were conducting a bar exam, and a woman had a heart attack and dropped to the floor, and they wouldn't stop the exam. Because there was timed was the excuse. And yet all of these prospective attorneys are taking this bar exam, were freaked out that this woman was passed out on the floor, and then medical personnel came to tend to her, and no one wanted to stop. Like, where did we lose our compassion and humanity for a human being that was literally sitting next to you 10 minutes ago?
Well, we're living in the end stages of this system. You know, I mean, people don't want to think about ideological questions. They don't want to be put in certain boxes, but there's an ideology running your life. And the ideology right now is profit above all else.
Yeah, I can't buy that, Joe. I mean, we've lost our humanity. There, everything, people have a value. I value people, not as capital, as humans, as
The system does it. The system just every, we probably talk about the Chelsea Elliott houses.
Oh, the Chelsea. Go ahead. Talk. You got a few minutes. Let's talk about that.
It was like that whole community is being slated for demolition so that private developers can come in there and build market rate housing and a couple of so-called affordable housing. Meanwhile, there's a thriving community right now, and they don't need to do it. And one of the first two buildings to be knocked down is a building that is exclusively for New York senior citizens.
Right.
So it's like they have special apartments that accommodate wheelchairs and walkers. All their friends are there. It's a safe building. It's near the local senior center. But you argue that if I had to argue this case with you, you were making a decision. You were like, oh, well, that's a lot to think about. But the powers that be, none of that is relevant. It's not relevant. It's just like, what is the bottom line as far as the money?
Yeah, this was a very passionate statement. It says Jacobs told the community board for his land use committee on Tuesday, that's it. That's all this has ever been. They want to create a Chelsea that is Hudson Yards and Hudson Yards only. They don't care about anyone in this room. They don't give a flying bleep about any poor people. They don't give a flying bleep about any of us. I mean, that's pretty much saying it all. How do you take elderly people, knock them out of their apartments, expect them to move their possessions when this building was designed for them to accommodate their needs and is senior friendly?
And that quote came not from a crotchety old codger. That came from a 21-year-old.
Really? I'm impressed.
Because that person realizes, like, oh yeah, my family's
Sees the pain.
been here for generations. I'm probably the end. I'm probably the end of that. It's not going to happen for me. I'm not going to be able to raise a family here. I'm gonna have to go somewhere else because we're getting pushed out.
I have to tell you, Joe, I have long said this, that I feel that this city is that there's an attack on the elderly. There's no respect for the elderly population. There's from criminals hurting, throwing seniors onto the train, knocking them to the ground, punching them, robbing them, to the administration trying to take their Medicare benefits, to not wanting to have a conversation with a senior organization like mine, for example, trying to speak to every politician running for office so that they know what the issues of a retiree, an elderly person has to deal with in this city.
Well, that's a
They don't
great
want to.
example, between linking a criminal and a power broker. What do? They prey on somebody who's the most vulnerable. And that's, yeah, like a criminal and private developers, privatization people driven by profit. They're both doing the same thing. They're preying on people they perceive to be as vulnerable and easy pickings.
Yeah, and they have a GoFundMe to help with their legal battles to try to protect their homes. I mean, they shouldn't. It's like us fighting for our health care. They're fighting for their
Exactly.
homes, and some of them, their homes and their health care.
Yeah, I mean, again, these are people, at the later stages of their lives, and you're asking them to move away for 3 years while we knock down your home, and then we're going to build something back, and maybe it'll be, but th that construction is going to take at least 16 years. So that's, what are you doing to those people's quality of lives at the end of their life? But again, what I'm talking about sounds silly because, in the grand scheme of things, the way things run, it doesn't matter.
Right. So now your article says WorkBites emailed and called Councilman Eric Boucher's third district for a comment for the story, but hasn't gotten a response. So I'm assuming he's previously expressed report for this demolition plan. He's not moving off of that position.
this is the same thing I'm hearing from the actual residents, you know, the constituents, and I constantly, you know, in covering the story, that's what I've been hearing, that we've reached out to Tony Simone, we've reached out to Eric Boettcher, we're not getting any answers, we're not getting any help. I'm just saying, hey, I just started doing my due diligence, digging into the story, and I can't get to the guy either. I just know it as a journalist, if somebody doesn't want to talk to you, it's not a good sign.
No, it's definitely not. And so then their next meeting for the community board to consider this plan would be September 3rd. That full board meeting will be held from 6:30 to 9 at Pier 57, located at 25 11th Avenue at West 15th Street in Manhattan. Participants are advised to walk through the food court to the classrooms in the back on the right. So hopefully everyone can come out and support the residents of this complex and help them protect their home.
Yeah, that'll be a meeting of the full community board for. Last week's was a meeting of the land use committee, and they actually voted against the plan as is. But residents are not happy because they feel like a door has been left open for some kind of private
Right.
development. And people, I could just tell you, the people that came out were unequivocally against any kind of privatization of their public housing.
Well, thanks, Joe. It's great to talk with you again and read all of these very interesting stories about the people that are fighting for some stage of their life, whether it's for their work, their life, their home. How can people find you and find your stories if they want to read more?
Yeah, please just go to workbites.com, workbites.com. And yeah, we're posting stories every day. And big rally coming up in March on Wall Street on Thursday against Trump's attack on education and DEI programs. So
Great.
we'll see what that looks like.
Well, thank you, Joe, and thank you, Reggie. Everyone, you have a great week, and we will see you Monday at 5 o'clock.
Good evening, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the headlines. Five journalists, including a photographer for the news channel Al Jazeera, are among 21 people killed in an Israeli attack on Nasser Medical Complex in southern Gaza on Monday. The Gaza Health Ministry said it was a double-tap strike where one missile hits first, followed by another as rescue crews arrived. The journalist's killing comes 2 weeks after another Al Jazeera journalist, Anas El Sharif, was killed with four colleagues in front of Gaza's El Shifa hospital. The death toll of journalists in Gaza is now at least 273. Amnesty International said no conflict in modern history has killed as many journalists as Israel's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. And the United States and Israel are waging a behind-the-scenes battle at the United Nations to restrict the use of UN peacekeepers called UNIFIL along the boundary between Israel and Lebanon. UN spokesperson Stephane Dujarric defended the peacekeepers role in Lebanon.
The fact that the men and women of UNIFIL, at the direction of the Secretary General, stayed during the worst part of the conflict, I think, is a testament to their bravery and to the critical role that they are now, especially now, being able to play.
The government of Lebanon said it rejects the withdrawal of peacekeeping troops. Israel has been battering the border area for months since last year's war with Hezbollah ended inconclusively. And in the Oval Office, President Donald Trump signed a raft of executive orders Monday giving more power to federal troops to fight crime in Washington, D.C. But the order catching the most attention was a crackdown on flag burning in the United States, reclassifying torching Old Glory as disorderly conduct with a one-year jail sentence and a felony record.
What it does is incite to riot. I hope they use that language, by the way. Did they?
Yeah,
incite to riot. And you burn a flag, you get 1 year in jail. You don't get 10 years, you don't get 1 month. You get 1 year in jail, and it goes on your record.
Once illegal, but legalized as free speech by the United States Supreme Court in 1989, it was a case stemming from a flag-burning episode at a 1984 protest against the nomination of Ronald Reagan for a second term in Dallas, Texas. The alleged perpetrator was a communist organizer, Gregory Joey Johnson. New York City attorney Ron Kuby and famed civil rights attorney Bill Kunstler took the case to the highest court. Kuby spoke with WBAI.
Not on my permanent record. I've always wondered, who looks at those permanent records? But seriously, folks, the Supreme Court twice held flag burning is constitutionally protected activity. It falls within the protections of the First Amendment.
Kuby said the case started because Texas law created a special category for the U.S. flag.
The state of Texas considered the American flag to be a sacred object. That was actually in the legislation. Any form of destruction of it or mutilation of it, including little cocktail napkins for weenies, was technically illegal.
Kuby added, speech that makes a listener angry is what the First Amendment is supposed to protect.
The response of people who hear your speech or see your speech might be a violent response is an argument that's always made for speech which people find objectionable, and the court has always rejected that. Otherwise, everybody's freedom of speech, no matter what you're advocating, has to be sacrificed because people might get angry and riot.
Kuby said protesters don't usually burn the flag because the